And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. Well, Patty, here we are on another episode talking about your incredible band, The Pleasure Seekers. And the last episode was such a wild ride because we're talking about, as you call it, the mishmash of lineup changes in the band. And now you're ready to go, as you said, carpe diem, and your new lineup change, which I want to get to. But welcome back. I hope you are enjoying this wild ride as much as I am and the listeners are.
Oh, I love a wild ride. I'm fully on. Let's go. Foot on the gas.
A girl in the Motor City. I love it. After my own heart. So we basically, on the last couple of episodes, we're talking about that Mary Lou, one of the original band members, was out because of parental pressure. Diane Baker was out because she was just kind of on the fence and she was geographically farther away. But you, Susie and Nan, as you said, foot on the gas, ready to go, ready to keep playing. You brought it back in, Chris Wenzel. And again, please listen to the last few episodes to know who these players are, literally. And then you bring in, as you called her, Sherry Hammerly, or nanosecond Sherry, because she was only in the band.
It's so true.
for a nanosecond. And so just a couple of loose ends from what we've been talking about so that we can move forward, because I wanted to be really clear for the listeners. So how did nanosecond Sherry Hammerly come into the band and then go so quickly? Give us a little recap of her.
I think we probably were caught, you know, with Mary Lou leaving and stuff, and it was the wild card position. So Sherry was she was a friend from high school, and we just sort of took the easy route. She played a little rhythm and sang good. So we stuck her in quickly just so we could keep booking and going, and she learned the songs. And then, she had a good look. She had a good look. But there, at that point, we realized we need to find somebody more serious with it. And so she was gone. That was it. We had to pick someone else.
Well, quickly before we go on with who you picked, when you say she wasn't serious, does that mean she was not a serious musician? She was not a serious member of pleasure seekers? She was not good, all of the above? Whatever you want to say here?
Probably all of the above, but it was more like she was just filling a slot. We were taking the easy way at that moment. We'd had so many changes. The record was out. I mean, we had to promote it. So it was like, let's just do something easy and find someone. And we did. And that was it, Sherry.
Well, and we are going to touch upon what you just said, which is your band was getting booked all the time at this point in 1966. I mean, gig after gig, we've said this. And so you did have to have a band to go out and play. This was not just trying
Yes.
to figure out where to play next. And so you bring in Eileen, if I'm getting the chronology correctly. So tell us about Eileen. Give us a background story to her.
Eileen was great. She was a choir friend of mine. She had a really good look. She had long blonde hair down to her waist, and her nickname, she became known as Lady Godiva. She had a good voice, and she taught herself rhythm guitar. She was serious and excited to be part of the band. And her dad even made an amp for her. He was fine with it all. He thought it was cool. So she was able even to handle some bass guitar when we did our revolving set of Motown songs, because we all would take turns on an instrument and then trade for the next singer. So she was even able to pick up a little bit of the bass and cope with whatever song she was going to play bass on. And, our Motown review was amazing. I mean, it was just part of our total repertoire by this time.
Well, one of the things that I find interesting as we're unpacking the history of the pleasure seekers is the parental theme, as we were saying. And you either had full support by the parents. I would even say Diane's parents were okay with it. I think that was
Oh,
more
yeah.
Diane's decision. Whereas the Balls were not okay with it, meaning the parents. But I
Right.
love that Eileen's dad built her an amp and was completely supportive of that. That's just a fantastic
Yeah.
tidbit to the story, and that he was so supportive. I love that. Well, another loose thread from the previous episode, in regards, speaking of, to parents who were not necessarily supportive, you said that it was Mary Lou and Ann's mom most especially, who was demanding that they leave the band. You said that Mary Lou was absolutely fine with quitting. She was going into, I think, her senior year or high school, whatever it was, but that it was Nan who was adamant and defiant in staying and pursuing music with the pleasure seekers. So I understand that she continued, and that she, you said you guys continued to play gigs together for a while. I mean, we're talking months and months after her
Oh,
parents
yeah.
gave her an ultimatum. And you were playing gigs, and we're going to get to the release of your singles on Valentine's Day in 1966. And there she is in the midst of it. And I'm just curious, how did this get concealed from her parents? How did they not know? I mean, the Grosse Pointe papers were talking about you. I'm just curious.
I think that her parents expected the PR stuff because it was like the tail end stuff. And they had talked to their kids after Christmas. They knew it was going to come out. We had made the record, for God's sakes. And Nan and Mary Lou were both in the picture. They just like, oh, okay, that's the end of it. So they weren't suspicious because they thought their kids were going to agree and follow their dictates, And they had no reason to be suspicious at that point. And they didn't pop into any gigs. I don't remember them even coming to gigs. They were that, oh, that's their little thing they're doing. And we were traveling to other cities by that point. So, it wasn't like they were going to drive to a city and see us. My dad showed up a lot of places, but we were doing the college circuit and clubs, January to spring, with Pris and Sherry and Nan still in.
Well, I love that. And that actually adds a little bit of color to what I want to talk about next, which is we talked in great detail on episode 10 about the making and production of your first two singles on Hideout Records, Never Thought You'd Leave Me and What a Way to Die. But what I want to talk about is some of the press that you got almost immediately. And Patty, thank you for this. You provided me with one press clipping somewhere around or right after Valentine's Day when it was released. And it was definitely 1966. And we'll get to more lineup changes that are going to happen down the line. But for now, what I want to do is read from one of the press clippings because I really think it offers an incredible mindset into you, 17-year-old serious Patty, as well as the seriousness of all the band, but also the way the audience and the fans and the city in general were accepting you. And so this article was written by a woman. Her name was Mary Joan Schmidt. And I found it interesting that this was not in the women's section, that she was a staff writer for the newspaper. We don't know which newspaper, but again, her name, Mary Joan Schmidt. And the headline for the band, it says, quote, "Pleasure Seekers feature teen band sound," close quote. And right off the bat, I give this female writer props for not using your all-girl band name as some kind of pun or some kind of tease. I mean, the headline alone, you would not know if this was a male band or a female band because it really just says feature teen band sound, insert band name there. And so I'm curious, first of all, I want to hear any background before we read from this article because it's really juicy and wonderful and in-depth. But do you have any memory about this journalist? Do you remember anything about the paper, how it came about, anything?
I don't remember the journalist. I know Detroit had a lot of papers. I think every Grosse Pointe had their own little, press rag. And this is so Detroit that she did not make it a gender thing. And I remember, besides her, other women journalists that supported us all along the way. They never played on that. Society, it was still novelty, unacceptable, weird. But the bands didn't feel that way. And the journalists were pretty damn cool and not getting into this gender thing. So I'm not surprised that she titled it that way. That is so Detroit. Put your own stamp on it and make it interesting.
Well, I really, really admire that. Well, and because of what you said about, in a way, having to hide Nan from her parents, it was obvious that PR was going to have to be done. She had played on the singles. But I did notice, and I didn't pick up on this until you just said that, that in the picture for the newspaper that was taken for the article, Nan is not in the picture. And it says in there, it notes in there that Nan is away at college, but it's tiny little print. So if you're just looking quickly at the photo, you would think there were four members and you would never know that Nan was in there, which I thought was really, really interesting. So
Well, Dave probably did a lot of that PR and got it together. He wanted to promote the single. So I'm not surprised that it might have been one isolated interview where Nan couldn't get back for the picture and we did it anyway. That's probably what happened, And honestly,
I'm assuming, like you, that's probably what happened too, since she was away at college and it was winter and all of that. But I do love the idea that too, that she was having to hide from her parents in PR. I don't know why that makes me giggle.
Oh my God.
Defiant Nan, I love her so much. Well, as we continue reading this article, the blurb under your photograph, speaking of, it says, which I also really love that this writer picked up on. She writes, quote, "Pleasure Seekers, one of the most popular vocal instrumental groups in the area. Grosse Pointe High School girls they are." And then she lists all of you, and this is such a different day and age, and I won't give the addresses, but she lists all of your home addresses in the paper publicly. And I thought in today's age, you would not do that at all with high school girls underaged. So, but the other thing is when she listed you, and it stuck out to me because I've known you since I was 6 years old as nothing other than Patty. And she quotes you often in this article, and you are nothing but Pat. So I'm really curious how were you Pat? And so I'm just talk about this.
That makes me laugh. I went through various name changes in the early days. I was a young kid developing my own little rock persona. I used to spell it differently, just stupid youth stuff. And I mean, we all played on that. You reminded me of something else. from a minute ago when we were talking about Nan not being in the picture. And this is interesting to me to remember. I don't remember if she told Mary Lou to keep it a secret or whether she didn't tell Mary Lou she was still playing. I don't know. And Susie and her were best friends. And somehow, you know, Nan didn't get in trouble for all those months. So I don't know what was happening. And I mean, a bit of trivia there. That was when she was dating Iggy, James Osterberg Jr. from Iggy. And he was in his first band, the Iguanas, as a drummer, right? And then he went into the Prime Movers and he changed to Iggy and moved up front to be the lead singer, the first mosh pit guy. And she was dating him at college then. Maybe she couldn't get back because she was on some hot dates with Iggy. Who knew? No. They were both at U of M. He wasn't in college. He worked at a record store and in the bands, but she was there. They were both in the same city. So,
well,
interesting stuff.
It is interesting stuff, and there is so much to that. But also going back to whether Mary Lou would spill the beans to her parents or not,
yeah.
I am making this up completely, having not been there, and I have not finished my time capsule machine yet. But everything you've told me about Mary Lou, it sounds like she was just completely immersed in her high school life.
Yes.
Probably oblivious to anything else that was going on in the world, as most normal teenagers would be, right? I mean, that's your own planetary system. And so I don't know, maybe that's why the Nan got away with it for as long as she did. Because if Mary Lou quit, let's just say the beginning of January in 66, right? Nan was there for months and months and months until the end of the year.
So we were busy. We were busy. Susie and her may not have been quite as close. We were gigging, practicing on school nights and stuff. So it would have made sense that in those very few months that their friendship, though still strong, drew away a little bit, you know, because she was involved in the band and Mary Lou wasn't. So I don't know if it was a big secret, but it's an unknown in the rock ether, as I always say.
Well,
I don't know.
Who would know is your sister Susie, and we should.
Yes, I could ask her.
Well, because also she had an agenda wanting the pleasure seekers to continue with Nan. So she too, I mean, yes, you were busy, so that gave her the complete excuse not to be hanging out with her and doing sleepovers per se. But I do think there was also a, what would it benefit the pleasure seekers if Nan was outed? So
she wouldn't have liked that. She would have been protective of Nan. She didn't want to lose the drummer. So that might have played into whatever did happen, you know? It's funny.
Well, that's go ahead.
To get back to your thing, yeah, I was changing my spelling of my name and doing silly things like that, just looking for my little persona. You know, I was, what, 17?
You were 17, but it also, at that moment, you were Serious Patty. I mean, or I should in this case, Serious Pat. And so and that comes through so clearly in the article. And that's, let me preface this whole thing with, Patty, that is not a put down. That is, I say this with full admiration, because by the age of 17 in this article, it is so clear who the leader is. So I want to continue reading from this article that Mary Schmidt wrote. And she starts off the article with something that also stopped me in my tracks as a historian, because remember, this is written contemporaneously with your single coming out. So this is February 1966. The music scene, rock and roll scene is it's not necessarily new anymore, but it's definitely new. I mean, this is...
Yes, it's in its infancy still.
Absolutely. And so she goes on to write, quote, Grosse Pointe, which is where you were playing and this is where your family lived. She says, Grosse Pointe is rapidly becoming the home of the teen band sound in the Detroit area. One of the fastest rising contributions to the entertainment industry can be found in five talented young ladies from Grosse Pointe High School who call themselves the Pleasure Seekers. Members of this unique all-girl vocal instrumental quintet are Susie Quattro, 15, singer and bass guitar, Pat Quattro, 17, lead guitar, Chris Wenzel, 16, portable electric piano, and Nan Ball, 18, drums, and Sherry Hammerly, 16, rhythm guitar. And that's who was in the lineup at that moment that this article was written. What I really want you to focus on is, first of all, that she picked up on what was happening in Detroit that early, and that she included you, the pleasure seekers, into that exciting explosion of new music, again, without any gender. Yes, she said five talented ladies, but there was, again, it was very much I don't know, an afterthought by including the gender. So talk a little bit about this.
I think that journalist was on point. She had her finger on the pulse, which is amazing at that era of, when rock was coming in heavy. She knew what was happening and she gave gravitas to the cultural shift that these five young teens were very popular and on people's radar by now. It's amazing. And by now, in the spring, the record was out. It was charted regionally, already so popular the kids wanted to hear it all the time at gigs. And, she did her homework. I have to, give kudos to her. She was right on point.
I agree with you, but I also want to add, or I should say, and not but, and I want to add into the fact that she was picking up on it within weeks of the singles being released. I mean, it's not like she was hearing, oh, rumor has it, there's this hot new band. I mean, yes, you were playing all over before the single was released, but she was already linking your teen sound with the teen sound of Detroit, especially in Grosse Pointe.
I don't remember the press in Detroit, including this woman, ever being disrespectful or making fun of it or making it a novelty. Even though society looked at it that way, the press were just Detroit cool. They just handled it well. We were another band. We happened to be women, and we were treated with respect always. I think that's great. I mean,
Well, and I want to add to that, and we've talked a lot about this in all the seasons we've done, but it is a pillar because this was happening in Detroit, whether you were male or female, animal, whatever you were, you had to be better than anyone else out there. So that it was not even a consideration of could you play, it was just how good you were. And clearly, the music critics and even the journalists were picking up on this.
Well, they couldn't deny it. If they came to hear us, interview us, whatever, it was obvious that when we walked on stage and started that we could play.